The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
We don't feel guilty when we're in the office on a Sunday night or when I'm traveling for work and away from my family. But boy, if I'm off with my family on a Wednesday afternoon doing something with them, you feel guilty about not being back at the office. That's a little bit upside down.
Sean Domnick on balancing career with family and how having cancer changed his life and his practice.
What that has done is given me more understanding of the struggle that people go through, the feelings that one has when you are faced with that diagnosis, and you learn that most things in life that at that moment seem so big, in reality are not.
And on ethical dilemmas facing trial lawyers.
What do you do if you have a client who has been horrifically injured? They have no resources. They have no money for food that night. Do you give them some money so they can buy some food, or do you say that's unethical?
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. All Sean Domnick ever wanted to be while growing up was a lawyer. Today, he represents some of the most catastrophically injured people in the country, many from medical malpractice, and has won among the largest verdicts. As you'll hear, he credits case preparation, but also a keen sense of empathy for his clients. He got an extra dose of that from his own bout with cancer. He's been a longtime board member of the Florida Justice Association and won many of its top awards. They include the B.J. and Tom Masterson Award for Professionalism and High Ethics, the John Krupnik Award for Perseverance in Achieving Justice for an Injured Client, and the McKinley Smiley Jr. Award for being a dedicated mentor to newer lawyers throughout his career. He'll share his tips on running a law firm and developing talent. Sean Domnick of Palm Beach Gardens sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in September 2020 to discuss the fear of losing, his growing frustration about justice delayed becoming justice denied, and the innovative way he balances career and family life.
Sean, your areas of specialization include complex wrongful death, product liability, nursing home abuse, but especially medical malpractice. In fact, you've had some of the top medical malpractice verdicts in the country. Is there one particular case that you want to talk about represents what you do and what you've done in medical malpractice?
Absolutely. I think that the Weissuckle versus LabCorp case is such a great example of the types of cases that I've been fortunate enough to be able to work on. And that was a case where Darren Weissuckle, wife, mother of two daughters, had regular pap smears, but despite that, ended up having cervical cancer. The cancer spread and she died. And trying to figure out how could that possibly happen. And it turned out that she'd had not one, but two of her pap smears misread. And if they had been, if the first one in particular had been read properly, simple basic medical care would have prevented her death and she'd have gone on to live a long, healthy, happy life with her husband and her kids. So, you know, we set out to answer the question of why, how is it that this is possible? And so we ended up suing LabCorp, and the case went to trial in federal court here in West Palm Beach. And what we learned was that these big box places are forcing the people who read these slides, the pap smear slides, to read too many of them in one day. And there's just no way that they can do their job properly with the amount of volume that they have to get through on any particular day. And that explained to us how and why this type of mistake could happen. And I had the person who reads the slide is called a cytotechnologist. They are 4 years of college and then post-college training in order to be able to do this job. They're well-trained. And at trial, all of a sudden, I started taking her through the math of the amount of time that she had to read slides versus the number of slides that she read. And I ultimately asked her, and the truth of the matter is, you don't have enough time in the day to do your job. And she said, if your math is correct, that's right. And then she agreed that my math was correct. So it was incredible. So we got this incredible jury verdict. Just what an incredible feeling for being able to get some justice for this family and an answer to how this needless, senseless death occurred and to hold somebody accountable. Then the federal judge did something called a remitter, knocked the jury verdict down tremendously. And so then we had to fight to get things back to where they needed to be, which took another long time and just added more insult to the injury that the family had already suffered through. But, what I learned as a lawyer through that, and just with regard to this type of case, is that it's not unique to them, and that there are other families and other women that were suffering from the same type of thing for the very same reasons that were out there. So since that case, I've handled, 10, 15, 20 more cases of similar things that are happening. And, one of the things that we as lawyers want to accomplish, there are really two things. We want to get justice for our clients. We want to make a difference in their life and do something that is going to make them feel like people cared about them, the system cared, and justice was accomplished. The other thing that we're trying to do is make our world around us a safer, more just, more fair place. And I'm still working in this arena to accomplish that because I haven't yet been able to effectuate the change that I want to do in terms of in this pap smear world, making sure that they're not forcing people to read too many slides in a day and not needlessly putting women's lives at risk.
And that ultimately ended up being one of your larger verdicts. That was about a $20 million jury verdict in the end, wasn't it?
It was a tremendous outcome. We had a great jury that understood the loss that this family had suffered, and this family was they took a lot of videos, and it was really interesting because Darian was not typically the one who was in the videos. She was in some, but she was always the one that was videoing her daughters. And she's always saying, mommy loves you, mommy loves you, mommy loves you. Hmm. And so in my rebuttal closing argument, I took snapshots from all of the different videos of her saying, mommy loves you, mommy loves you, mommy loves you. And I closed with those snapshots and it just, it resonated.
Hmm. Some of your cases involve nursing homes and other elder care issues. One of your colleagues has commented that you strike fear in the heart of negligent medical providers.
Wow, that's quite a compliment. I want them to be afraid. I want them to be careful. I want them to be not negligent. But if they are, they need to be afraid about what it is that's going to happen to them. That's part of how it is that we make the world a safer, fairer place is by making people afraid to do things that are wrong. But it's part of, I think, the preparation that I put in to my cases. And just as with real estate, it's location, location, location. In our business, it's preparation, preparation, preparation. And there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into before you take a deposition, for example, and thinking about how it is that you're going to start that deposition. What is it that I want to accomplish? What's the best way that I want to accomplish it with? And I think of a neurosurgeon on a case that I had once where, you know, my first question after what was his name, I forget what the question was, but he said to me, "Well, that's a stupid question." And I said, "Well, fortunately, you have to answer my stupid questions." But I knew that as soon as he said that, I had him. You know, he was the puppet on the string that I was going to be playing with throughout the next couple of hours.
Beyond the preparation, is there any other particular skills that you link to your trial success?
Well, I think innovation is important, and the preparation allows you to innovate. And a really good example of that was I tried a case in Melbourne several years ago, and the theory of the case was that it was an older doctor who was using an outdated technique and that he needed to keep up with the times. And there was things that had been developed since he had gone out of medical school that would have been much less risky and would have eliminated the issue that led to the paralysis of my client. And this was right when iPads were coming out. And so what I decided to do was rather than utilize typical boards that we had used for so many years in our trials, that I was going to present all of my evidence using an iPad and using a Apple TV and putting it onto the TV screen in that manner and have the x-rays on the iPad, and the expert was able to enlarge them and minimize them that way. And so my theory that I was trying to be consistent with was, look, here I am being up to date on the latest things that are there and using that. Look, they're still using, the defense is using the old boards, just like the doctor used the old technique. And so psychologically, I was being consistent with the theme of my case.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah. And it worked out very well for the client.
Sean, you've been practicing now for 31 years. You're a University of Florida undergraduate as well as law school graduate. Let's go back to the beginning. What made you want to be a lawyer?
I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that all I ever wanted to be was a lawyer. From the time that I can remember, that was what I wanted to do. And in fact, when I got off to college and all of a sudden they say you have to have a major, I said, I don't need to have a major. I'm going to be a lawyer. And they said, no, that's not the way it works. And then I made the mistake of calling my mom and saying, hey, mom, they say I have to have a major. And she gave me one of those mom answers, which was, well, you ought to have something to fall back on in case the law doesn't work out. So how about accounting? So, okay, what do I know? So I started with accounting. First accounting class, fine. Everything was good. Finally, after 2 years, I told her, I said, if I have to take another accounting class, I'm going to jump off the bell tower. I just, I can't take it at all. So ended up getting a degree in finance. But, you know, that was one of those moments where you don't know what it is that you don't know about life. And you learn along the way with things. But to the point is, I just always wanted to be a lawyer, and I don't know what the motivation was for it, but I've never wanted to do anything else once I realized that I was not going to be a professional athlete.
Sure. So you get out of law school in your first law firm. Tell us about that, and did you have a mentor?
You know, so I started out doing insurance defense work for a couple of years, and I got into a very lucky situation because the setup that we had in the law firm was a senior partner, senior associate, and junior associate. And of course, I was the junior associate in our division. But within a month or two after I joined, the senior associate left to go somewhere else, and her caseload fell to me. And so I got to try over 20 cases in the span of about 15 months. And that was just an incredible opportunity for me at that time. So, and during that time period, the head of the firm, Richard Cole, was really a mentor to me during that time period in terms of helping to understand how to look at the law, how to think about the law, you know, think about what you're trying to accomplish. On the plaintiff side, from a mentor point of view, we're very lucky, and we're very lucky here in the state of Florida because we've had the FJA, and you know, when I started, of course, it was the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers. And so it created this statewide sense of community among plaintiffs' trial lawyers, where lawyers with experience would be available to us to help us and to answer any of the questions that we might have. And of course, you know, I was so fortunate to be at the Searcy Denny firm for so many years and learn from people like Chris Searcy and Jack Scarola and Greg Barnhart, and to learn not just that you need to make sure that you are a great lawyer, but you need to be a great person in the process.
Sean, what have you learned along the way since then?
Well, one of the things that I learned along the way is that we spend the first so many years of our practice trying to be everybody but ourselves. We go and see what it is that somebody else is doing, and we try to copy it. And that's good enough, but then you learn that you can't just copy what somebody else does. You have to take the essence of what it is that you're learning from them and then internalize it and be yourself. And once you're able to start to combine those two things, a whole new sort of aha awakens for you, and now you're able to be yourself and true to yourself, and it reflects with the jury where they understand that you are being genuine with them. And you know, one of the biggest compliments I had, I was trying a case, and I got an email from one of the jurors who was a prospective juror but didn't end up getting selected for the jury. But he sent me an email and he said, you know, during jury selection, all of us could tell how much you cared about your client. They said the defense lawyer was a jerk. Somebody in the jury would say something that was emotional and meaningful, and he would just like ignore it. If that happened when you were asking questions, you stopped and you connected with the person like that. So getting that feedback told me, okay, I'm starting to understand. I'm starting to learn what it is that I need to do in order to be a really good lawyer, you know, because it's a constant evolution.
Is part of that empathy?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. If you cannot, you know, sympathy is feeling sad for somebody. Empathy is understanding their sadness. And I think there's a real big difference there. You have to be empathetic in order to be a good plaintiff's trial lawyer, in order to be able to communicate to a jury the loss, not just the loss. I mean, in order to measure loss, you have to show what was there. And so we have to show how wonderful, for example, somebody's relationships were before the person died, or how great this person's life was before this tragic injury befell them. You have to be able to show that before you can show what the loss means. And then a jury can quantify what that loss is in terms of dollars. And you can't do that well if you don't spend the time and care enough to really understand your client.
Sean, now you are a cancer survivor. How has that changed your practice?
I think that what that has done is given me more understanding of the struggle that people go through, the feelings that one has when you are faced with that diagnosis. It's given me a greater sense of trying to understand what is really important and what's not important, both personally and as you run a law firm and as you handle your case, and try not to let things get out of control that don't need to be, you know, try not making mountains out of molehills. And you learn that most things in life that at that moment seem so big in reality are not. Those big things are really limited to a very, very few things. So, you know, those are the things that you learn from that. And you learn to take some time for yourself and to be a little more reflective about what it is that's going on. It just gives you perspective. That's a hard thing because it's not something that I sit and think about, and I don't ponder about it on a daily basis. And I'm not the type of person who sits there and says, why me, or why did this bad thing happen to me? We learned from this business that bad things happen to good people, and there's no good damn reason for why it happens. So spending a lot of time lamenting the fact that something bad happened doesn't move you forward at all.
Along the way, you have won many honors. You're a member of the American Board of Trial Advocates, the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, Best Lawyers in America listed since 2005, Florida Super Lawyers, Florida Trend Legal Elite for many years, National Trial Lawyers Top 100. You ended up in the last few years working with another fellow titan of trial, Fred Cunningham, and you play an active management role in that firm. Let's switch gears a little bit from managing a law firm, because a lot of lawyers are not naturally business people. What can you share some of your best practices to managing a law firm?
It's difficult. They don't teach us about how to run a law firm in law school. I think they expect that we're just sort of supposed to know it, and that's not the way that it works at all. So, you know, managing a law firm is, of course, managing different personalities and understanding your own personality. And I look at it like in sports. If you listen to players and coaches, and they'll talk about it's the coach's job to set the player up for success so that when the player is in that moment that they can perform. I think that that is our job with our employees, is to set them up for success and to work with them so that they can do their jobs. I'm not a micromanager. I don't think that's a particularly effective working style. So you have to find people that you have confidence in. Hire excellence. Overpay if you have to overpay, but hire excellence. And then empower that excellence to do what it is that you hired them to do. You have to be there for support and have fun along the way. Make the office, it's serious work that we do, but you need to make it so that people enjoy going to work. Lead by example. Don't ask them to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself and that you don't show them that you already do. I'll empty the garbage if the garbage has to be emptied. And if they see you doing that type of thing, then they'll do it and gladly follow you along the way. Learning how to manage money and finances takes time. It's not an easy skill to learn. But one of the things that I tell my young lawyers, I say, I'm not at the first law firm that I ever started with, and it's the rare lawyer that stays with the same firm. So one of the roles that I view for myself is to teach you not just to be a good trial lawyer, but to learn to be a lawyer who is independent and the master of your own fate. So that's teaching how is it that you go about generating cases? How do you run a law firm? What are the issues that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis? The terrible feeling when you come to the realization that you have to let somebody go, and that struggle that you have between how many chances do I give them before I realize that that person is really inhibiting us from our mission and causing the morale to go down, and you got to do what you got to do with regard to that, and how do you handle those types of things? So there are so many sub things, and so I think that it's our role to communicate well, to help everybody understand what our mission is, what it is that we are trying to accomplish, how we want to go about trying to accomplish it, and being there to give the guidance and the support that you need to give.
How do you find the quality of young lawyers today seeking employment at your firm?
I think that the quality of young lawyers today is similar to the quality of young lawyers when I was younger and probably what it was like before I started practicing. There are some tremendous people out there that are going to be fabulous lawyers and are wonderful human beings. And there are other folks out there that just really aren't cut out for this business. You know, there are so many more lawyers coming out of law school right now, and there are only so many jobs that are available. So I know that it's really a hard job market for graduates that's out there. But there are some wonderful people who I know are really going to be great lawyers, and I have great confidence that the future is in good hands.
Sean, was there a point that you didn't think you were going to make it?
There was never a point where I didn't think that I was going to make it. My philosophy has always been that whenever I've been presented with a chance or an opportunity, it wasn't like, oh, if I did it and it didn't work out, that meant that I was not going to be able to make money. There's always a defense firm or somebody like that that'll hire you. So it was never going to be this or zero. And so I learned that you have to have, you know, confidence in yourself, bet on yourself. And when those opportunities present, take them. You always regret the things that you didn't try versus the things that you did try.
Throughout your career, you have been heavily involved with the Florida Justice Association. You are the winner of many of its top awards, the John Krupnik Award for Perseverance and Fortitude in Achieving Justice on Behalf of an Injured or Vulnerable Client, the McKinley Smiley Jr. Award for Dedicated Counsel given to newer lawyers throughout your career. Of course, the BJ and Tom Masterson Award for Professionalism and High Ethics. You're a frequent workshop leader. You are a multiple Eagle Award recipient for your tremendous generosity to the Florida Justice Association. Sean, how has your involvement impacted your career?
My involvement with the FJA has helped make my career. I started when I was a young lawyer back in 1995. I first got on the board of the FJA, and that was right at the time period where Florida was undergoing a political upheaval, and the attacks on our practices started in real earnest during that time period. So there was not a lot of time for sitting back at that moment, and it was a call to arms. And so we all had to respond to that. And as I said earlier, we have this incredible statewide army of people who are unified and understand that when somebody else is successful, it's not a time to be jealous, but a time to be grateful and recognize that the rising tide lifts all of our boats. And so the FJA has been instrumental in the growth of my career, my development as a lawyer. I have developed relationships that are lifetime relationships. My family, my kids grew up going to FJA conventions. They're part of the FJA family. It's been the springboard for me getting involved in the American Association for Justice, where I'm now an officer, and in a couple of years, I'm going to be president. None of that would have been possible without what it is that I learned through my interaction with the FJA.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
Boy, that's a loaded question. So, ethics in this business are incredibly important. And you've got to do the right thing. And people have to know that you are going to do the right thing, and that they can count on your word. And that a judge is going to know that if there's a case that's on point that's against you, you're going to let the judge know about it. You're going to explain why it may not apply in this particular case. But building a reputation of honesty and dependability and ethical behavior is incredibly, incredibly important. The only reason I hesitate is that there are moments where something may not be ethical, but it's moral. Let me give you an example. What do you do if you have a client who has been horrifically injured? They have no resources. They have no money for food that night. Do you give them some money so they can buy some food, or do you say that's unethical? There are moments that are that the quandary and the struggle between those two things is really can be really hard when you represent human beings and we see them in the conditions that we see them in.
And sometimes lawyers are their last resort, their last defense, if you will.
Lawyers are their last resort. The system is not designed to help these people other than through us. But the problem is our justice system too often doesn't care about people. The insurance company, the corporation, they don't go home at night thinking about a particular case. That's all our clients can think about because that's all the lifeline that they may have to a future. And we have these systems that are set up to grind our clients down where we can't get the cases to trial on time, where justice delayed is too often justice denied, and the system just doesn't care. And that's one of the things that makes me so frustrated about it, where we go in and somebody says, oh, you know, this case is going to get continued for 9 months or a year or something like that. Well, my client doesn't have 9 months or a year. Or that's going to add another $100,000 onto the cost of the case. Or that means my client's got to go borrow money at 100% interest because that's all they can do in order to survive. Because this terrible thing that happened means that they can't work. And so this goes back to the empathy and understanding of our clients and fighting for them and making sure that we understand what it is that they need and figuring out how to do it, but also fighting the system. Like I get so mad. I read about in the Florida Bar magazine or the journal about, oh, that they want to develop business courts so that businesses can go through the system more quickly and more efficiently. How about if we develop courts that are designed for catastrophically injured people so that a little brain-injured baby doesn't have to wait 5, 6, 7 years before they get justice? Mm. How about we do that? How about we care about people?
Good point.
That's one that gets me on my soapbox.
Understandably so. This is a very difficult profession, very time-consuming. You are dealing with complex issues, built-in frustrations. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
You have to make it a priority to achieve that type of balance. The law really grabs at you, and with today's technology, it can be with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so one is you have to make it a priority to have that balance. Like, you know, one of the things I make sure I do every day is work out. It helps get rid of all of that stress that I do. But, you know, I set aside time to be with my family and make sure that I put my electronics away when I'm dealing with them. One of the great opportunities that I had was several years ago, my wife and I took our 3 kids out of school. They were in high school, middle school, and elementary school at the time. And we were able to travel through Europe and the Middle East and Africa for 9 months, homeschooled them along the way. I would fly back and forth as necessary to do work. I was able to work from afar with Skype and things like that. I could still get in 6 and 7 hour work days and people wouldn't even know where I was. So that was something that we were able to make work. And I tell people, you may not be able to do that, but you can figure out your version of that.
Innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it is, at the end of the day, life is about relationships and the memories that you develop with those people that you have relationships with. And the most important relationships that we have are the relationships that we have with our families, and we have to develop those memories with them. Everything else at the end of the day to me is secondary. And sometimes we forget that. And sometimes, you know, we don't feel guilty when we're in the office on a Sunday night or when I'm traveling for work and away from my family. But boy, if I'm off with my family on a Wednesday afternoon doing something with them, you feel guilty about not being back at the office. That's a little bit upside down. And we have to figure out as lawyers how to sort of reverse that a little bit and make sure that we have that family time, we have that personal time, and that we don't attach guilt to the fact that we're taking that time. Instead, we ought to view it as being empowering to us. And if we are more balanced and more happy and more fulfilled, we are going to be better lawyers. We're going to be stronger lawyers. We're going to be more empathetic lawyers. We're going to be better fighters because we're more well-rounded.
What about regrets?
Regrets? I've had a few. I tend not to look back at the problems that I've had. I tend to, you know, focus on the good things. But I think that most of the good lawyers that I know are motivated by fear. Like if Pat Riley, the general manager of the Miami Heat, talks about how, you know, when he's asked about the joy of winning championships, and he says, "That's great, but I'm more motivated by the fear of losing." And I think that most of us are more motivated by the fear of losing than we are by the joy of winning. And sometimes some of the victories can kind of meld together, but I can point out every loss that I've had and beat myself up for the things that I think that I should have done better. And even in the cases where I've had tremendous results, you end up beating yourself up saying, if I'd only done this, I could have gotten an even better result for my client. So those types of things, that negative energy tends to motivate us, I think, more than the joy of success. But you have to keep it in balance, and nobody's perfect and nobody has a perfect record, and everything should be a learning experience, and we have to figure out, if we did something wrong, how not to repeat it and, you know, move on.
Sean, how would you like to be remembered?
First, I'd like to be remembered as a great father and a great husband. Beyond that, I'd like to be remembered as somebody who cared deeply about people and fought for justice just as hard as he could.
Sean Domnick, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.